no more ado, I want to pass on to what we're looking at today. Margaret Macmillan, I've admired for a long time. I wrote her book Peacemaker some years ago, and I have, as some of you know, quoted it on numerous occasions. And I think it was one of the most instructive books about how the work of man is not necessarily the final answer to the problems of the world, and quite often the world decides there are other problems to produce in order to counteract the attempts of man to solve them. Anyway, she is the warden of St. Anthony's College. She is the professor of international history at the University of Oxford. Her books include Women of the Raj, which came out in 1988, Peacemakers, the Paris Conference of 1919, and its attempt to end war in 2001, Seize the Hour, 6 Days That Changed the World in 2006, The Uses and Abuses of History in 2008, and her most recent book is The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and an officer of the Order of Canada. She tells me she sat up late into the night watching the Canadian general election results, which I think were a pleasant breath of fresh air in a world where, as a retired politician, I rather like to see surprises. Anyway, I'm going to ask her to speak to us now about how peace ends and how wars start, the relevance of the First World War today. Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret.
Thank you very much indeed for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for having what I hope will be the patience to listen to me. I thought perhaps I should talk about more topical things, the Canadian federal election, but perhaps on reflection, 1914 is a bit more interesting, certainly to people here. What I want to do is talk about how wars start, and I think it's not just how they start, but how peace ends, because I think there is in any society a balance between war and peace. And I think one of the dangers in looking at how wars start is we tend to think they were predetermined. Because they started, we tend to think they had to start. And the trouble, of course, with the First World War is there's so many possible reasons why it might have started that we tend to overlook the reasons why it may not have started or should not have started. I think we don't learn very clear lessons from history, and I don't think we'll get a blueprint for how to deal with the future. But I do think we are living in a world which is not unlike that in certain key respects of the world before 1914, a time of rapid change, whether technological or social, a time which had its tensions, challenges to governance structures, rapid movements of people around the world, rapid transmission of ideas, rapid transmission of finances, and I think also uneasy feelings that this might all be too fast. And I think an uneasy feeling, which again I think is very reminiscent of today, that the international power structure is changing in ways that we're not yet entirely clear about. As I say, I don't think history is going to help us predict what is going to happen in our own times, but I think it helps us to gain understanding, and particularly in complicated and troubled times, we need as much understanding as we can get. I think history helps us to understand others, and I think this is very important. One of the things that so clearly was happening as Europe moved towards the First World War was that people were failing to understand what those on the other side might be thinking. What they were doing was projecting onto others their own fears and their own assumptions. And so the Germans tended to assume they knew what the Russians were thinking. The Russians tended to assume they knew what Austria-Hungary was thinking. The British tended to assume that all the foreigners were thinking strange things and they needn't bother really to pay much attention to it. But I do think this is important to try and understand the cultural values, the biases, the assumptions that others are making so that we can at least have some sense of why they're behaving in certain ways. I think it also helps us to understand ourselves better. We all tell stories about others, but we also tell stories about ourselves. And we persuade ourselves that our motives are always for the best and those of others are always for the worst. And I think history will help us at least to look with a certain amount of analysis and a certain amount of necessary skepticism about ourselves and others. The other thing I think where history could help as we try to puzzle out the present is that it helps us to be aware of possibilities. It helps us to be aware that things are not foreordained, I don't believe they are in history, that there are alternatives, and it makes us aware of those alternatives. We look back at the history, for example, of Russia, and today I think we're tending to assume that Russia is inimical to the West, that it is intent on mischief. But of course, there have been other Russias and other relationships that Russia's had with the West. And it's, I think, useful at least to remember that there are those other possibilities. I think history also helps us to formulate questions. And if we can't ask questions about the present, then we don't have any hope of trying to make any sense of it. And so what history can do is help us think through by offering similar situations, not situations that are the same, but similar, so that at least we can say, are we in a situation, as Europe was before 1914, where the war plans were increasingly offensive, where they were assuming that a general war was going to break out? I mean, I don't think we are in such a situation today, but it will help us at least to be aware of that possibility, to ask the questions. And I think it is very important to be able to ask questions, to try and understand what sort of things we need to know. And I think a final way that history helps us is to distinguish between what is genuinely new and what only seems to be new. Because we tend always, I think, in every age to assume that everything that's happening is happening for the first time. And history, I think, helps to remind us that sometimes similar things have happened before, that not everything is absolutely new under the sun. What I'd like to do is just look a bit at 1914, and then look at the First World War itself, and then look at some of the consequences, and suggest where there might be parallels with today. Not to say that these are exact parallels, that we're living in anything like the world of 1914, but simply to say there are some instructive parallels. One thing I'd like to talk about is globalization. We tend to assume that our age is the age of the greatest globalization the world has ever seen. But if you look at the decade or so before 1914, it was a period of tremendous globalization. The world was linked together economically, through new forms of communication, through mass movements of people. As many people were moving around the world as have moved around the world since the end of the 1990s. Globalization, so many of those at the time thought, and I think we've heard very much the same in the past decade or so, was going to knit the world closer together, was going to iron out differences among people, was going to make us more dependent upon each other, and therefore was going to help make the world a more peaceful place. And I think if we look at the period of globalization before 1914, we realize that that was not necessarily the case. Globalization did not necessarily bring greater harmony between peoples. Germany and Great Britain were each other's greatest trading partners before 1914. That did not prevent them from developing very acute rivalry, colonial rivalry, of course, naval rivalry, trade rivalry, and in the end did not prevent them from going to war against each other. And I think we can see something similar today with China and Japan. With China and the United States, that these two countries are linked together economically. There are enormous trade between the two of them, enormous investments by the Chinese in American treasury bonds, for example, big American investments in China, but this has not led to greater harmony. And so I think we need to have a certain amount of skepticism about globalization and its benefits. I think what globalization also brought before 1914, and I think we're seeing it again today, is it brought a resistance by those who weren't benefiting from it. And globalization does not benefit everyone equally, and there are losers. There were losers then, and there are losers today. For example, in Europe, the spread of cheap agricultural goods, undercut land prices. The big wheat fields that were opened up in the Americas undercut the prices that landowners in Europe were getting for their wheat and for their other produce. And there was a gradual movement of people having to sell their land, landowners being dispossessed. Many of them, understandably, turned to parties which seemed to protect them. And so you've got the rise of protectionist movements, and in some cases, very right-wing movements. In the cities, you got resistance to mass industrialization, the mass production of cheap consumer goods, again, which was fostered by globalization. You got resistance from small shopkeepers, artisans, whose livelihoods were being undercut and in some cases disappearing. And it was those sort of people who fueled the right-wing and in many cases anti-Semitic parties in cities such as Vienna or Berlin or the other great cities of Europe. And so globalization can be, as we know, extraordinarily disruptive and can lead to a reaction, people seeking parties which seem to offer some sort of protection against the winds of globalization. And I think you also find, as you found today, before 1914, people taking refuge in smaller identities. And strong nationalist movements throughout Europe before 1914, often based on smaller and smaller ethnicities. And I think we're seeing something of the same today. I think this is part of the impetus between, for example, Basque nationalism, Catalan nationalism, and, of course, Scottish nationalism. Globalization also, of course, was not just about the movement of goods and peoples, but it was also the spreads of ideas. And while many of those ideas helped to open doors for people, many of those ideas were also disruptive. And so you saw the rapid transmission through print mainly, and through the telegraph, through mass newspapers, of ideas such as terrorism. The period before 1914 was a period in which there was real concern about what people called anarchism. Tremendous number of terrorist activities, bombs thrown on the floor of the Paris Stock Exchange, for example. A number of leading figures were assassinated, including one of the Tsars of Russia, Spanish Prime Minister, French Foreign Minister. These were periods when people felt uneasy about what globalization meant and uneasy about the ways in which disruptive ideas were traveling. And so I think globalization is one of the themes I'd like to call your attention to, but it does have very mixed impact and very mixed consequences. The second thing, I think, is the very pace of change. People felt before 1914 that change was almost too quick. There was a lot of worry about what rapid transit was doing to people. When the French metro opened, there were very worried articles in French newspapers saying that going on the metro, people will be going too fast and something will happen to their nervous systems. Their nerves will get jangled. A new disease was invented called neurasthenia, and people whose nerves were stretched too much by the modern world. And what the newspapers also pointed out when the French metro opened was that it would be a very fertile field for pickpockets. In that, at least, they were right. But there was, I think, a fear at the speed of change, at the ways in which society was being transformed, and considerable worry, and I think we're beginning to get it again today, about what this meant to be human. What did the rapid changes in society, the advances in medical science and other sorts of science, the new sorts of activities that people were undertaking, what did this mean for society? What did it mean for human nature? What did it mean for human beings? In 1914 and the years before, there was tremendous concern about degeneracy. Was the human race going downhill? Was it in some ways losing contact with nature? Real concern that far too many people were living too long and reproducing themselves thanks to medical science. And it's by no coincidence, I think, that in this period you get the first eugenics movement, an international movement which had adherents in many countries, the idea that you could somehow keep the race from becoming degenerate by breeding it and by weeding out the unfit. This was not just a fringe movement. The International Eugenics Congress held a meeting in London in the Royal Albert Hall in 1912, and its patrons included the president of Harvard University, Alexander Graham Bell, and Winston Churchill. So this was something that I think spoke to a deep-rooted concern. And I don't think we're in danger of seeing another eugenics movement today, but I think we do have concerns about what science and technology are doing to what it is to be human. There's talk now about enhancing human capabilities through drugs or through nanotechnology. What is this going to do to us? Are we going to become partly computers and partly human in some as yet unforeseen way? And so I think I detect a sort of ripple of concern, very like what there was before 1914, that something is happening and we're not quite sure what it is and we're not quite sure what science is doing. And there is, I think, in our own times, as there was before 1914, a reaction to science. There were those who said science can't explain anything, can't explain everything, and is in fact leading us down a sterile and dangerous path. And before 1914, I think there was a very marked increase in spiritualism, people who believed they could get in touch with an unseen world, a deep interest in the things that couldn't be quantified, couldn't be measured, and things such as the human spirit. And I think we're seeing something of the same today. There are those who are now becoming very apprehensive about where science might be taking us and becoming very skeptical about the idea that science can explain or settle everything. Another area where I think there are similarities between 1914 and today is in the importance of public opinion. It takes a different form today, of course. Increasingly, politicians are looking at the Twitter sphere or looking at blogs. I'm increasingly aware of that whole electronic world. But I think they feel the same sense of bewilderment and sometimes frustration that politicians and political elites felt before 1914. There was this new and rather difficult force to deal with. How did you measure it? How did you manipulate it? And they were increasingly thinking before 1914 about how to manipulate public opinion. A number of foreign offices set up their own departments to deal with the press, and governments increasingly were aware of the need to keep the mass media, mainly the press, on their side. And I think then, as now, governments found public opinion sometimes contradictory, bewildering, and frankly quite unhelpful. Lord Salisbury, the great Conservative Prime Minister, said in 1890, he said, "I don't like this public opinion. I don't like the fact that my government has to be aware of it." He said, "It's like living in a gigantic lunatic asylum, but I have to live there." I mean, this was something that now had to be dealt with. And I think we do have, I think, a similar feeling today that public opinion is unpredictable, frequently irrational, will push political leaders in directions in which they may not necessarily want to go. Before 1914 as well, I think there were, you can see increasingly the importance of ideas. And I think there is a tendency, perhaps particularly in prosperous democratic societies, to rule out or to downplay the importance of ideas. But I think before 1914, we see just how important the ways in which people thought about themselves and others were, and the ways in which people thought about what sorts of societies they might want. And I think this has been borne in on us again since 2001. No one, I think, in the 1990s, or few in the 1990s, would have predicted how important religiously inspired visions of the future or visions of alternative societies would be. And I think we're realizing yet again just the great power that ideas can have. Before 1914, the great revolutionary and mobilizing ideas were revolutionary socialism in all its various manifestations and nationalism, both of them forces which were very difficult to control, which would persuade their adherents to, if necessary, give their lives for them, very difficult to predict where people would suddenly pop up. You had before 1914, as you have today, young people radicalizing themselves. The young Bosnians, as they were known, who plotted to kill the Archduke at Sarajevo, had read about Russian revolutionary terrorists, had read about French revolutionary terrorists, and had radicalized themselves and had decided on their own that they would try and assassinate a leading figure from Austria-Hungary. And fate, of course, sent them one of the most important figures of all in the shape of the Archduke. And I think we're seeing something very similar today. The mechanisms through which people radicalize themselves may be different, but the phenomenon is there. And of course, we still do see ethnic conflicts today, nationalist conflicts, and I think we are getting a fresh appreciation of just how difficult these are to contain and how difficult to manage. Another parallel, I think, between then and now is the role that fear played and does play in our own times. Here was a very prosperous Europe, a Europe which had had a century of almost unbroken peace. There had been wars, of course, but they'd almost entirely, except for the Crimean War, been between only two protagonists. They'd been short and they'd been decisive. And so Europeans, by 1914, had come to think that war was something that, if it happened, would actually settle something, would not have a great cost to the rest of society. But increasingly, I think Europeans were starting to think that war would not come at all. And so on the one hand, you had this society that had a certain degree of complacency, a certain degree of assumptions, certain types of assumptions about the future. But at the same time, it was a society that was racked in some ways by fears. Fears of degeneracy, fears of what the modern world was bringing, but also fears of one class but another class. A number of the European governments before 1914 were very apprehensive about their own working classes, afraid that there would be revolution. And you got in certain countries, Germany for one, those who argued that in fact a war would be a very good thing because it would mobilize the nation, bring people together, it would overcome the divisions, the social and political divisions within the nation, and or it might provide the excuse and the opportunity to crack down on things like unions, constitutions, Reichstags. Bethmann Hollweg, the German chancellor, had a great deal of trouble in July 1914, as it became evident that Germany was going to war, to persuade the militarists and the Kaiser himself, the militarists around the Kaiser and the Kaiser himself, that they should not immediately ban all trade unions, they should not immediately treat all socialists as if they were traitors. He said, rightly, they're Germans and I can bring them along. And, of course, bring them along he did. But this was a fear, and I think it helps to contribute to the sense of an uneasy Europe, a Europe which, on the one hand, seems to have so many advantages before 1914, but is fearful about what those advantages might mean. And so I think there was that fear, and there was also fear of others. Increasingly you get, and it's tied in, of course, with nationalism and the mass media, but increasingly you get peoples in one country, and this is a popular phenomenon, not just at the level of elites, people in one country increasingly concerned that peoples in another country are, in some ways, their hereditary enemies. And social Darwinism, which purported to divide up the human species into a number of antagonistic races, plays a very large part in this. And you get French military attachés in Berlin writing back to their government in Paris saying, well, you know, we don't expect anything of the Germans. They're planning to attack us. We know that. After all, they are our hereditary enemies. And that is, I think, extremely dangerous. And that is exactly what, of course, the Germans were saying about the French at the same time, or the Germans were saying about the Russians, or the Russians were saying about the Germans. There was a lot of talk before 1914 about how the Teutons and the Slavs were condemned by nature to fight each other. That was simply a fact of nature. We're getting something the same today, I think, in some of the rhetoric around the relationship between the United States and China on both sides, that our peoples are so different in their cultures, in their interests, in their values, that it is understandable that they will be at odds with each other. And it's a very dangerous rhetoric because it tends to assume that something is inevitable, which most certainly is not. But I think it is dangerous. And that, of course, feeds in to the assumption that the other side is planning to do something. If your hereditary enemy is just over the border, well, they're bound to be planning to do something to you. And so Germany became, or the German high command, became increasingly apprehensive of what the Russians were up to. The more the Russians built railways, the more the Germans became convinced that this was part of a coherent plan to invade Germany. I don't think Russian planning was that coherent, but certainly there were those in Russia who said, sooner or later, we have to have a war with Germany. And where that fed in to creating greater instability in 1914 was that the German high command put pressure on the Kaiser and on the civilian leadership, saying, look, if a war is coming, which is likely because we're bound to fight the Russians sooner or later, we must do it now. We will not be able to do it in 1917 because Russia will be too strong. Rather, the same argument that the Japanese militarists used in 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. The second thing, I think, that was happening with the fear, not just of the enemy, but there was also fear about your own allies. And this is something, I think, which helped to add to the instability. And I think, again, we can see parallels for today. Germany was worried about losing Austria-Hungary before 1914 because they didn't really have anyone else. And they knew they couldn't rely on Italy. The Italians had made it quite clear that they would think of their own interests first, and I think this was a very sensible decision by the Italian government. And so from the German point of view, if they didn't back Austria-Hungary as it moved to confront Russia over Serbia, they might lose it. And that meant, and we can see it again today, that the weaker ally actually pulled along the more powerful ally because the more powerful ally didn't dare admit that it could no longer support its weaker ally. Russia did the same with Serbia before 1914. I think we see something the same today with, for example, the United States and Taiwan, the United States and Israel. I think you get a sense in which the weaker partner, in fact, has a tremendous amount of leverage over the patron, and that can be dangerous. The other sort of fear was in the fear of simply not being able to go to war when it was necessary. There was a great fear about what this would mean for the honor of the nation. And we got language before 1914, which doesn't have an exact parallel today, but I think there's something similar, a talk of the honor of the nation, how if we back down, we will no longer hold our heads up. In July 1914, in St. Petersburg, as they were trying to decide what to do about Serbia and about the growing threat from Austria-Hungary, there was a lot of talk about how Russia will never be able to hold its head up again as a great power if it doesn't back Serbia this time. Some of them said, better to perish bravely than not to fight. I'm not sure we get exactly the same language today, but I think when nations talk about prestige and credibility, there's something of that notion there that we can't afford to back down because of what it might mean to us. The final parallel, I think, I'd like to draw is in the complacency which a long period of peace can engender. Europe was a tense continent. There were domestic difficulties within most countries. The British, of course, were preoccupied with the Irish question for most of July 1914, which is why they didn't pay enough attention to what was happening far away in the Balkans. I think the complacency was dangerous because people tended to assume that the period of peace would go on. Because there had been a series of crises, people tended to assume that we'll get through them. You know, that we've got through so many. There'd been crises in 1908 over the annexation of Bosnia by Austria-Hungary. There'd been crises in 1911 over the Italian invasion of Tripoli and a Moroccan crisis. A crisis in 1912 with the First Balkan War. crisis in 1913 with the Second Balkan War, and on each occasion there had been talk of a general war, people saying, this is probably it, we might well have a general war, and some people saying, actually, it'd be good to get it over with. That was also a dangerous sort of sentiment, that we're living in a sort of something like the time before a thunderstorm, which would be a great relief to us all if we get it over. But what you got in 1914 was this sort of cumulative effect of these previous crises, where people said it's just another crisis. We've just had two crises in the Balkans. We know how they'll turn out. There'll be a lot of talking, a lot of huffing and puffing. There'll be mobilization of troops. There'll be some preparations to put pressure on the other side. But that's all deterrence. And then there will be a conference of ambassadors. That was Sir Edward Grey's solution to the two previous crises. His solution again in 1914, we'll call the powers together. We'll revive the Concert of Europe. We'll put pressure on the two antagonists who by, of course, the end of July 1914 were at this stage primarily Russia and Austria-Hungary. The rest of us will put pressure on them and we'll tell them to make some sort of settlement. And that's what most Europeans thought would happen. It looked exactly or very much like the other crises. And so, of course, they failed to take it seriously until it was nearly too late. And it was not just the ordinary public who failed to take it seriously, it was those who were actually making the decisions. The editor, Theodor Wolff, who's the editor of the Berliner Zeitung, very important newspaper, always took his family to Ostend in Belgium for their summer holidays on the seashore. And he was preparing to take his family on the 27th of July for their usual summer holiday. And he said to the German Foreign Secretary, von Jagow, who was a friend, he said, look, things seem a bit tense. Do you think I should really take my family to Belgium? And von Jagow said, of course. He said, this will settle itself like all the other crises. You're perfectly safe. And so off Wolf went with his family, deposited them with their buckets and umbrellas on the seashore and went back to Berlin and had to go back the next day to get them and very nearly didn't get them out in time. And a very, very dangerous complacency. And I think we should be careful of that today. We've had, at least in the West, not the rest of the world, but in the West, we've had an extraordinarily long period of peace. And I think we've come to think that it will go on forever and that somehow we will muddle through. And I think, finally, where the First World War should worry us is that we don't always muddle through, as it shows very clearly. And human failings and accident can play a very large part. I think it is still possible, if Europe had had better leadership in July 1914, it would not have gone to war. I mean, the crisis that unfolded in the Balkans was a minor crisis by the standards of the time. It was, of course, a blow to Austria-Hungary. They'd lost the heir to their throne. Not that they mourned him much. He was not popular in Austria-Hungary, but they had lost their heir. And it was really the decisions by individuals to make something of that crisis which turned the crisis into something much more serious. In Vienna, they had been waiting for an excuse to deal with Serbia, which they saw as an existential threat to the future of Austria-Hungary. Serbia as the magnet for all the South Slavs living within Austria-Hungary, and the Serbs talked in such terms, was for Austria-Hungary a threat to its very existence. If the South Slavs began to get restive, then so would the Poles, so would the Ruthenians, so would the Italians, so would the Germans, so would the Czechs, so would the Slovaks. There would be nothing left. And so for Austria-Hungary, Serbia had to be contained or destroyed. And the assassination of the Archduke gave them the opportunity. And they were reckless. They knew that Russia might come in. But they tried to tell themselves, and I think our capacity to deceive ourselves is huge, they kept telling themselves, yes, Russia could come in, it might have an excuse, but they won't. They don't really want war. They're not ready for war. And they projected into Russia what they hoped would be the case. And Russia, of course, was ready for war. And so I think the quality of leadership in 1914 was a very key factor, and the decisions that were made. And the second, of course, fatal decision, in my view, is Germany's decision to back Austria-Hungary completely, knowing again that Russia might come in. And again, that was a human decision. It was not inevitable. Germany had not backed Austria-Hungary on previous occasions. It could have done the same this time, even at the risk of losing Austria-Hungary. And that might have been best for Germany, because by allying itself to Austria-Hungary, it took on Austria-Hungary's quarrels with Russia in the Balkans. These were not Germany's quarrels, but they made them their quarrels by supporting Austria-Hungary to the hilt. And so the decision was made in Berlin, and I think it's a reflection of the way that the German constitution was constituted, that the Kaiser had far too much power. He had his own military cabinet. He was ultimately responsible for foreign policy and defense policy, military policy, and he was not someone who should have been entrusted with that power. I mean, I look at the crowned heads of Europe before 1914, I think it's a very strong argument against the hereditary principle. The Tsar in Russia, who then, of course, the third piece in this awful chain of events. And it's a very short time. It's only 5 weeks from the assassination to the outbreak of general war. 5 weeks from a long period of peace to the catastrophic war of 1914-18. And Russia then took the decision that it would mobilize in support of Serbia, and it would mobilize against Austria-Hungary. And the Tsar, who was a weak man, very decent man, very good to his family, but not, again, I think, fitted to be the Tsar of all the Russias with all the sort of pressures that were on him, was pressured by his generals to order a general mobilization. And he said, can we not mobilize just against Austria-Hungary? And he was told, no, our plans don't allow for it. And I think that was not just a failure of the moment, that was a failure to look previously at what the military were planning. I mean, I think it is absolutely essential that you know what your military are planning, because otherwise you reach a crisis and they say, sorry, we've only got one plan, we will have to follow that. And so the Tsar, who resisted the pressure, finally caved in, signed a general mobilization. The foreign minister, Zazanov, went to get his signature. He was in his palace outside St. Petersburg, went to get his signature, phoned it through. The phone was just coming in at this point, phoned it through to the general in charge of mobilization and said he's finally decided to authorize mobilization, smash the phone. We don't want any changes of his mind. And so Russia mobilized, and then Germany faced the same problem, and again the same issue came up. It turned out the German military only had plans for two-front mobilization. And the Kaiser, who wasn't strong enough to stand up to them, said, look, can't we just mobilize against Russia? And they said, no, we've only got the one plan. And again, he gave way. So I think if you look at the period before 1914, it's accident. It's a failure of leadership. And I think we should be very, very worried that the same thing can happen again. The structures, in the end, were not strong enough to deal with it. And of course, once the First World War stopped, it proved to be almost impossible to stop. Once you get war on that scale, which nobody really had, I think, imagined, or very few people had imagined, it involved societies as a whole. It involved not just manpower, it involved the people in the factories, it involved the wives, the families at home, and of course it involved the children because they were the future soldiers. And so you had to coin a new word, as the French did, and they called it total war, and war indeed was becoming increasingly total. But it became difficult to stop because once you had lost on that scale, it became very difficult to say, this was all a mistake. Now, people have often asked me, why didn't they just stop at Christmas 1914 and say, look, this was a mistake, and we're all losing, let's just make peace. You can't say it. You can't say it to your publics when you've already lost 200,000 men, 300,000 men. Some of the greatest losses in the First World War were in those first few months of 1914. The war went on, and of course, in its wake, it absorbed more and more of the resources of society, it brought in more and more nations, and it left a dreadful legacy for Europe. And I think this is something we should be conscious of. I don't see necessarily the same things happening today, but possibly you will think of parallels. War was extended in ways that people had not imagined before 1914. It was extended to civilians, it brought in science, it brought in resources, it brought in mass psychological mobilization. And I think we're seeing something of an extension of war today in different ways. We're seeing an extension of war to things, to the cybersphere. This is, I think, a whole new area of war. We're seeing, of course, as you saw in the First World War, the use of propaganda to mobilize your own side and to undermine the others. The Islamic State has been absolutely brilliant in its use of propaganda. It's been one of its great strengths. I think what also happened as a result of the war was the brutalization of society and a weakening of social structures. I think it's fair to say, social and political structures, that without the First World War, we would not have had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. The war made it possible. And I think we would not have had the spread of revolutionary ideologies through Europe without the First World War. The war both brutalized society and shook the faith of Europeans in their own structures and in their own societies. And I think it's very striking how much more violent politics became after 1918. Mass violence in the streets, brutal sort of street theater, the use of assassination, some 300 political assassinations in Germany in the first few years of the 1920s. And so I think you see what prolonged war can do. And I think we're seeing the same, not in Europe, of course, which has at least temporarily, and we hope forever, moved beyond that, but we're certainly seeing it in parts of the world such as Afghanistan, Yemen, the Middle East. I mean, these wars, low level as they may seem, are inflicting damage on society, which I think will take a very long time to rebuild and to repair. So where are we today? some ways, of course, it's different. I think we have stronger international structures. We have far more state players than there were in 1914, and that may be a good or a bad thing. We do have something they didn't have so much in 1914, and that is failed states, which provide haven for terrorists of various sorts and also provide a destabilizing influence on their peripheries. And that is something which we haven't yet learnt to deal with. We do still have the possibility of war on a number of levels. We tend to think that the future of war will be low-grade wars with high-grade weapons, with shifting sides, as you're seeing in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq today, with people changing sides for temporary advantage, inflicting enormous amounts of civilians, the unfortunate civilians who happen to be in their ways, but not necessarily destabilizing the wider world or only causing a momentary concern to the wider world through terrorist acts. This is possible, but I think we still face the possibility of wars between organized states. This has not yet gone away, again, possibly not in Europe, but if you look at the relationships between China and Japan, or China and the United States, those relationships are tricky. They're as tricky as some of the relationships before the First World War, and I think offer the possibility of state-to-state conflict. So I'm not offering any very clear solutions. I'm saying I think that we're in for a very difficult and turbulent time. The news in the past year has only confirmed, I think, at least on my part, that view, but I'd be very interested to hear what you say. And we still have the old problem that you had in 1914. How do you produce good leadership when you need it, and how do you cope with accidents? And I don't have an answer to either of those. Maybe you do. Thank you.